Chapter 115. The Calabooza Baratani, about a mile from the village we came to a halt. It was a beautiful spot. A mountain stream here flowed at the foot of a verdant slope. On one hand, it murmured along until the waters, spreading themselves upon a beach of small sparkling shells, trickled into the sea. On the other was a long defile, where the eye pursued a gleaming, sinuous thread, lost in shade and verdure. The ground next the road was walled in by a low, rude parapet of stones, and, upon the summit of the slope beyond, was a large, native house, the thatch dazzling white, and in shape an oval. Calabooza. Calabooza Baratani. The English jail, cried our conductor, pointing to the building. For a few months past, having been used by the consul as a house of confinement for his refractory sailors, it was thus styled to distinguish it from similar places in and about Papeete. Though extremely romantic in appearance, on a near approach it proved ill-adapted to domestic comfort. In short, it was a mere shell, recently built, and still unfinished. It was open all round, and tufts of grass were growing here and there under the very roof. The only piece of furniture was the tox, a clumsy machine for keeping people in one place, which, I believe, is pretty much out of date in most countries. It is still in use, however, among the Spaniards in South America, from whom, it seems, the Tahitians have borrowed the contrivance, as well as the name by which all places of confinement are known among them. The stocks were nothing more than two stout timbers, about 20 feet in length, and precisely alike. One was placed edgeways on the ground, and the other, resting on top, left, at regular intervals along the seam, several round holes, the object of which was evident at a glance. By this time, our guide had informed us that he went by the name of Cap'n Bob, Captain Bob, and a hearty old Bob he proved. It was just the name for him. From the first, so pleased were we with the old man, that we cheerfully acquiesced in his authority. Entering the building, he set us about fetching heaps of dry leaves, to spread behind the stocks for a couch. A trunk of a small coconut tree was then placed for a bolster, rather a hard one, but the natives are used to it. For a pillow, they use a little billet of wood, scooped out, and standing on four short legs, a sort of headstool. These arrangements completed, Captain Bob proceeded to anapar, or secure us, for the night. The upper timber of the machine, being lifted at one end, and our ankles placed in the semicircular spaces of the lower one, the other beam was then dropped, both being finally secured together by an old iron hoop at either extremity. This initiation was performed to the boisterous mirth of the natives, and diverted ourselves not a little. Captain Bob now bustled about, like an old woman seeing the children to bed. A basket of baked arrow, or Indian turnip, was brought in, and we were given a piece all round. Then a great counterpane of coarse, brown appa was stretched over the whole party, and, after sundry injunctions to M.O.E. and B.A.T.I. in other words, to go to sleep, and be good boys, we were left to ourselves, fairly put to bed and tucked in. Much talk was now had concerning our prospects in life. But the doctor and I, who lay side by side, thinking the occasion better adapted to meditation, kept pretty silent, and, before long, the rest ceased conversing, and, wearied with loss of rest on board the frigate, were soon sound asleep. After sliding from one reverie into another, I started, and gave the doctor a pinch. He was dreaming, however, and, resolved to follow his example, I troubled him no more. How the rest managed, I know not, but for my own part, I found it very hard to get to sleep. The consciousness of having one's foot pinned, and the impossibility of getting it anywhere else than just where it was most distressing. But this was not all. There was no way of lying, but straight on your back, unless, to be sure, one's limb went round and round in the ankle, like a swivel. Upon getting into a sort of doze, it was no wonder this uneasy posture gave me the nightmare. Under the delusion, that I was about some gymnastics or other, I gave my unfortunate member such a twitch that I started up with the idea that someone was dragging the stocks away. Captain Bob and his friends lived in a little hamlet hard by, and when morning showed in the east, the old gentleman came forth from that direction likewise, emerging from a grove, and saluting us loudly as he approached. Finding everybody awake, he set us at liberty, and, leading us down to the stream, ordered every man to strip and bathe. "All hands, my boy, Anna, wash," he cried. Bob was a linguist, and had been to sea in his day, as he many a time afterwards told us. At this moment, we were all alone with him, and it would have been the easiest thing in the world to have given him the slip, but he seemed to have no idea of such a thing, treating us so frankly and cordially, indeed, that even had we thought of running, we should have been ashamed of attempting it. He very well knew, nevertheless, as we ourselves were not slow in finding out, that, for various reasons, any attempt of the kind, without some previously arranged plan for leaving the island, would be certain to fail. As Bob was a rare one every way, I must give some account of him. There was a good deal of personal appearance about him. In short, he was a corpulent giant, over 6 feet in height, and literally as big round as a hogshead. The enormous bulk of some of the Tahitians has been frequently spoken of by voyagers. Beside being the English consul's jailer, as it were, he carried on the little Tahitian farming. That is to say, he owned several groves of the breadfruit and palm, and never hindered their growing. Close by was a arrow patch of his which he occasionally visited. Bob seldom disposed of the produce of his lands. It was all needed for domestic consumption. Indeed, for gormandizing, I would have matched him against any three common council men at a civic feast. A friend of Bob's told me that, owing to his voraciousness, his visits to other parts of the island were much dreaded, for, according to Tahitian customs, hospitality without charge is enjoined upon everyone, and though it is reciprocal in most cases, in Bob's it was almost out of the question. The damage done to a native larder in one of his morning calls was more than could be made good by his entertainers spending the holidays with him. The old man, as I have hinted, had, once upon a time, been a cruiser too in a whaling vessel, and, therefore, he prided himself upon his English. Having acquired what he knew of it in the forecastle, he talked little else than sailor phrases, which sounded whimsically enough. I asked him one day how old he was. "Oh, olay!" he exclaimed, looking very profound in consequence of thoroughly understanding so subtle a question. "H. Very olay, 1,000 year more big man, when cap'n to tea, Captain Cook, heavy in sight, and sea parlance, came into view." This was a thing impossible, but adapting my discourse to the man, I rejoined, "H. You see cap'n to tea well, how you like him?" "Oh, he mate I. Good friend of me, and know my wife." On my assuring him strongly that he could not have been born at the time, he explained himself by saying that he was speaking of his father all the while. This, indeed, might very well have been. It is a curious fact that all these people, young and old, will tell you that they have enjoyed the honor of a personal acquaintance with the great navigator. And if you listen to them, they will go on and tell anecdotes without end. This springs from nothing but their great desire to please, well knowing that a more agreeable topic for a white man could not be selected. As for the anachronism of the thing, they seem to have no idea of it. Days and years are all the same to them. After our sunrise bath, Bob once more placed us in the stocks, almost moved to tears at subjecting us to so great a hardship. But he could not treat us otherwise, he said, on pain of the consul's displeasure. How long we were to be confined, he did not know, nor what was to be done with us in the end. As noon advanced, and no signs of a meal were visible, someone inquired whether we were to be boarded, as well as lodged, at the Hotel de Calabuza? Vast heavy, a vast heaving, or wait a bit, said Bob Alco Food, Om Ship Bye Bye. And, sure enough, along comes Rope Tarn with a wooden bucket of the Julia's villainous biscuit. With a grin, he said it was a present from Wilson. It was all we were to get that day. A great cry was now raised, and well was it for the landlubber that lie had a pair of legs, and the men could not use theirs. One and all, we resolved not to touch the bread, come what come might, and so we told the natives. Being extravagantly fond of ship biscuit, the harder the better, they were quite overjoyed, and offered to give us, every day, a small quantity of baked breadfruit and Indian turnip in exchange for the bread. This we agreed to, and every morning afterward, when the bucket came, its contents were at once handed over to Bob and his friends, who never ceased munching until nightfall. Our exceedingly frugal meal of breadfruit over, Captain Bob waddled up to us with a couple of long poles hooked at one end, and several large baskets of woven cocoa nut branches. Not far off was an extensive grove of orange trees in full bearing, and myself and another were selected to go with him, and gather a supply for the party. When we went in among the trees, the sumptuousness of the orchard was unlike anything I had ever seen, while the fragrance shaken from the gently waving boughs regaled our senses most delightfully. In many places the trees formed a dense shade, spreading overhead a dark, rustling vault, groined with boughs, and studded here and there with the ripened spheres, like gilded balls. In several places, the overladen branches were borne to the earth, hiding the trunk in a tent of foliage. Once fairly in the grove, we could see nothing else. It was oranges all round. To preserve the fruit from bruising, Bob, hooking the twigs with his pole, let them fall into his basket. But this would not do for us. Seizing hold of a bough, we brought such a shower to the ground, that our old friend was fain to run from under. Heedless of remonstrance, we then reclined in the shade, and feasted to our heart's content. Heaping up the baskets afterwards, we returned to our comrades, by whom our arrival was hailed with loud plaudits. And in a marvelously short time, nothing was left of the oranges we brought but the rinds. While inmates of the Calabooza, we had as much of the fruit as we wanted, and to this cause, and others that might be mentioned, may be ascribed the speedy restoration of our sick to comparative health. The orange of Tahiti is delicious, small and sweet, with a thin, dry rind. Though now abounding, it was unknown before Cook's time, to whom the natives are indebted for so great a blessing. He likewise introduced several other kinds of fruit. Among these were the fig, pineapple, and lemon, now seldom met with. The lime still grows, and some of the poorer natives express the juice to sell to the shipping. It is highly valued as an anti-scorbutic. Nor was the variety of foreign fruits and vegetables which were introduced the only benefit conferred by the first visitors to the society group. Cattle and sheep were left at various places. More of them anon. Thus, after all that of late years has been done for these islanders, Cook and Vancouver may, in one sense at least, be considered their greatest benefactors. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.